Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky returns with part two of his fine talk on what should progressives do now? And then a brief memorial to singer, songwriter, and labor activist Anne Feeney. I hope you'll stay tuned. Noam Chomsky was interviewed by the Jacobin Channel on January 12, 2021. The questions put to him are long and convoluted, so I will restate them in concise English. As always, Chomsky's answers are detailed, coherent, and clearly organized. I'm jealous. Much of Chomsky's talk today focuses on the war on the working class, launched by the U.S. elite and assisted by the federal government. The war goes back centuries, but it intensified late in the Carter administration, really took off under Reagan, and has never stopped. Democratic administrations carried on the war just as enthusiastically as Republican administrations. The details Chomsky gives are eye-openers. Yet Chomsky's prognosis is cautiously optimistic. The people can never cease their organized struggle against the system, he says. But that struggle has yielded some victories along the way. Following Chomsky's talk, a few reminiscences about the late singer-songwriter and labor activist Anne Feeney, and one of her songs, which beautifully complements most of the points Chomsky is making. Anne died on February 3, 2021. On to Chomsky. The first question is, both political parties seem to be ignoring the working class. What do you make of this?
By the late 1970s, late Carter years, the Democrats basically told the working class, we don't have any interest in you, started in the late 70s. The last gasp of pro-labor activity in the Democratic Party was the Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment Act in, I think, 1978. Carter didn't veto it, but he watered it down so that it was toothless. It was left voluntary, okay, meaning nice words, but you don't do anything about it. From that point on, the Democrats essentially abandoned the working class. A few gestures here and there. When Clinton came, take a look at NAFTA. And NAFTA was rammed through in secret over the objections of the labor movement. They weren't even informed until the last minute of what the framework was, investor rights agreement. Actually, they came out at the last minute. The Labor Advisory Council did come out with an alternative program for NAFTA, say, here's a much better way to do it. Your version, the executive version, is going to lead to a low-growth, low-wage economy. Here's a way to do it with a high-growth, high-wage economy. Happened that their program was almost the same as that of the Congress's own research agency, the Office of Technology Assessment. Congress at that time did have a research agency. Congress decided they don't want to be bothered by stuff like information, so they destroyed it a couple of years later, but used to be around. But the OTA program and the LAC program, Labor Advisory Committee, were quite similar. Nobody paid attention to them, never reported. The executive branch didn't care. They wanted their version of NAFTA, which perfectly clear in advance that you have an arrangement that's basically an investor rights agreement that sets working people in competition with each other without rights. You can tell what's going to happen, and it did. In fact, worse than what was expected. Turned out that under Clinton's NAFTA, corporations were able to break organizing efforts at a very high level. About 50% of them were broken simply by threats to move the enterprise to Mexico. The threats weren't serious. They weren't going to do it. But the threat is enough to break the organizing effort. Happens to be illegal, but when you have a criminal state, you can carry out illegal acts. So they were carried out very effectively. That's only one example. But Labour has just been smashed by the Democrats. Well, I told you what happened in 2008. You know it yourself. But 2008, Labour voted for Obama. 2010, gone. They had seen what the promises meant. I remember what happened then. This was the midst of a financial crisis, huge financial crisis caused by the collapse of the housing market. Congress under Bush, in fact, had passed legislation, TARP legislation, to do something about it. The legislation had two components. One was to bail out the perpetrators of the crisis, the banks who had caused the crisis with predatory lending practices and other devious semi-criminal actions. So you have to bail them out. The other part of the legislation was to bail out the victims, people who had lost their homes under foreclosures, lost their jobs, do something for them. Anybody who knows American history and politics could have predicted which half of the legislation was going to be implemented by President Obama. Well, maybe workers didn't know all the details, but they could see it in their lives. Within 2 years, the working class had large parts of it, even the unionized working class, it said, this party isn't working for us. They're our enemy. Where can you go? You can go to the guys who claim that they're going to bring back traditional America or get you jobs. They're not going to do it, of course, but they at least claim to. You take a look at Trump voters. They've been carefully studied. A lot of them say, yeah, we know he's a jerk. He's not going to do anything. But at least he says that he likes us. Okay? He stands up and says, I'm with you. I'm one of you guys. I act like you. It's like George Bush, W. Bush. You may recall that on every weekend he would go off to Texas and his farm and be filmed cutting brush on 100 degrees temperature to show he's a real ordinary guy, you know. After he left office, I don't think he ever went back there. Put on this act, you know, I'm one of you guys. Sometimes it's comical. Remember John Kerry, when he was running, decided to show he's an ordinary guy. So he went windsurfing.
Yeah.
That won a lot. Well, let me just say that the Trump voters, if you look at them, the most careful studies I've seen are those of Tony DiMaggio, a very good social scientist, is. And it looks like, once again, apart from the evangelicals, you know, the white supremacists, apart from those sectors, the main voting base for Trump is basically petty bourgeois. Incomes from $1 to $200,000, way beyond the median. That's not working people. That seems to be the main base. And even greater than in 2016, it seems to have increased, the only part that increased substantially. A lot of working people think, well, at least he says something nice to us. The Democrats don't do anything. Actually, we saw this dramatically in, so take, say, South Texas. There's been a lot of study of why South Texas, which hadn't voted for a Republican for 100 years since Harding, moved towards Trump. These are Mexican-American communities. How come they broke with 100 years of voting Democrat? Well, you take a close look, you can see why. First of all, the Democrats didn't make the slightest effort to do any organizing. They're Hispanics, they vote for us. People don't like that, you know. But there was a more serious reason. These are oil-producing areas. All that they heard was Biden wants to take away our jobs and destroy our families, destroy our economies, because a bunch of pointy-headed rich liberals claim there's a climate crisis. Okay? If the Democrats cared at all about working people, they would have been down there saying, look, there's a climate crisis. We are going to have to transition away from fossil fuels, period. You don't do that, nothing's going to be left. But you can have better jobs, better lives, better economy by moving towards working on changing the industries, maybe under your own control, to sustainable energy and constructive development, like mass transportation instead of traffic jams, lots of other things. That's what organizers do, okay? They didn't bother. Working class is not their constituency. So they voted for the guy who says, I'm going to bring your jobs back.
Question two. Whether they are Republicans or Democrats, can working people unite to fight for their own class interests?
Well, first of all, they have to have something to vote for. If the Democrats say, we don't care about you, now we're the party of Wall Street and rich professionals. We have Hollywood stars at our events, and who cares about you? Yeah, they'll vote for the guy who's, I like you, I act like you, I hate the elite. Vote for that guy, even if he's not doing anything for them. And in fact, them. If you want to look at these Republicans who claim to be pro-working class, take a look at how they vote. So take a look at how they voted on the one legislative achievement of the Trump administration, the tax scam, which gave a huge amount of money to the very rich and is stabbing the working class in the back. How'd they vote on that? How do they vote on the way the CARES program was administrated, so that it goes to banks who then decide how to distribute it and they give it to their rich clients? So billionaires are making out like pirates. It's amazing. They're doing great. So ask how they voted on that. Now take a look at the actual legislative actions. It's very easy to get up and say, I'm for the workers, you know, easy. If nobody else is saying anything else, maybe people will say, well, at least he says he likes us. Unless there's an alternative, the votes don't mean anything. People are voting just out of frustration if they vote at all. Remember, almost half the population doesn't even bother. So unless there's a constructive alternative, people aren't going to join. And there can be. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you look at the United States. Take a look at the liberal press, the most liberal commentators, people I like, actually, writing about the Sanders campaign. They said his proposals are very good, but they're too radical for the American people. We've got to be more mild. We can't be that radical. What are the proposals that are too radical? Well, take a look at Sanders's, the programs he highlighted. Top one, universal medical care. Do you know of any other country that has universal medical care? I mean, can you think of a country that doesn't have it? Of course they're in favor of universal health care. Who isn't, you know? The other program is free higher education. Again, you find it almost everywhere. The most high-performing countries, Finland, others, sure, Europe, Mexico, it's all over the place. That's too radical for the American people. I mean, that's an insult to the American population that's hard to find words to express. That's coming from the left end of the mainstream spectrum. Well, the left, the authentic left, ought to be able to break through that. They ought to be able to break through and say that Sanders' programs, it wouldn't have much surprised Eisenhower. Eisenhower was strongly pro-New Deal. His position was anyone who questions the New Deal doesn't belong in the American political system. I mean, under the neoliberal years, things have moved so far to the right at the elite level, at the power level, that it's hard to remember what was normal not long before. Well, these are tasks for the left. You can reach people with that. You can reach people with reviving the labor movement, moving towards a labor party, pressing the liberal part of the Democratic Party towards moderately social democratic ends, particularly on things like climate. Should also mention nuclear weapons. It's not talked about. It's a major threat to our existence. The threat is increasing enormously. One of Trump's many crimes was to dismantle the whole arms control system and initiate moves towards creating very dangerous new weapon systems. That has to be terminated quickly, or we're in serious trouble. That can be done. All of these things can be done. There's plenty of options open. I don't think there's a shortage of causes to engage in actively. Problem is the will to do it.
Question 3. To prevent climate catastrophe, it looks like we will have to replace capitalism with something else. Should climate activists define their goal as socialism?
It's useful, but there's some facts we have to remember. One of them is time scale. We have a decade or two to deal decisively with the environmental crisis. We're not going to overthrow capitalism in a couple of decades. I think that doesn't mean you stop working for it. You can continue working for it, but recognizing that the solution is going to have to come within some kind of regimented capitalist system, not the neoliberal system. There are a variety of kinds of capitalism. So you go back to the pre-neoliberal period, this period of so-called regimented capitalism, very different from this. And within that framework of serious government control of the destructive excesses of unleashed capitalism, you have a chance to proceed. Meanwhile, you should be doing exactly what you said, trying to undermine these. And again, I think people can understand it. Take the fundamental evil of capitalism, which was always understood by traditional socialists, namely the fact that you have to have a job. We consider having a job a wonderful thing. Working people in the early Industrial Revolution regarded it as an obscenity, a fundamental attack on essential human rights and dignity. Now, that was such a strong position that it was a slogan of the Republican Party under Lincoln, that wage labor differs from slavery only in that it's temporary till you can become a free person. Well, that can be implemented by worker control of the enterprises in which they are part. You're not going to get it in, actually you can't even get it in one step, like worker-owned enterprises, which are proliferating. But you can get it by a series of steps, even which have been proposed, like Warren and Sanders proposed worker representation on the corporate managing boards. It's not very radical. Germany has it, for example, conservative country. But it gives you some step forward. You can move forward beyond that with actual direct action on the ground, like, for example, worker-owned enterprises, to changing the nature of the way in which the capitalist system works. You have a carbon tax. Don't do it like they did it in France, Macron, which led to the Yellow Vest movement. A carbon tax which hits the working class, designed to hit the working class. Yeah, you do that, you're going to get an uprising. You can have a carbon tax in which the revenue is returned to the public in a progressive manner. Then it benefits the working class. Yes, you pay a little more for gas, but you get more in return. Same with health care. Save a huge amount of money if we had a universal health care system, but you are going to pay higher taxes. And you'll save twice that much on your insurance premiums. So if you get that to people, okay? Those are the tasks for the left. Educational, organizational, activist, I think this is a tremendous range of opportunities available. But it's not enough to know what to do. You have to do it.
The final question. How can you be so optimistic?
Well, one easy way is to just look at what I see on the screen. People committed to struggling for a better world. And there are plenty of people like you. Okay? Perfectly good reason to be optimistic. I mean, I can't do it much more, getting too old, but I used to travel around a lot to some of the poorest, most oppressed areas of the world. Laos, southern Colombia, Kurdish areas in Turkey, Palestinian refugee camps, most miserable places you can find. Plenty of people are optimistic. They don't give up. Incomparably worse conditions than ours. And opportunity, we have opportunities they can't dream of. But they don't give up. They're struggling. You go to a poor rural community in Colombia, you know, hours away from the highway, get to the community, the first thing you see is a small cemetery where graves, white crosses for people who were killed in the latest paramilitary attack. You get into the town, welcome, have a meal, go to a meeting. They're talking about how to save the mountain next to them from corporate predators who'll destroy their water supply and so on. But they're struggling, optimistically. I mean, you see people like that everywhere, here too. How can you not share in their optimism with all of our privileges and advantages?
Noam Chomsky, still fighting the good fight at age 92. But progressives have lost another important voice, another good guy. Folk singer Ann Feeney died on February 3, 2021, at age 69. Died in Pittsburgh, where she had been born in 1951, where she had lived for most of her life, and where I had gotten to know her somewhat in the 1970s. In her later years, her health had been fragile. She had survived cancer. But in January, a fall had broken her back. Then, in the hospital, she contracted COVID and then pneumonia. That killed her. Before and after she became a folk singer, Anne was a labor activist. She had been a labor lawyer on the side of the good guys, the workers. I knew Anne in the 1970s when I was in graduate school and she was in law school. She made her career change from labor lawyer about 15 years later, when she was in her early 40s. We had lost touch before then. In the early 21st century, as I was beginning New World Notes, I kept coming across references to Pittsburgh folk singer Ann Feeney. Wait, I knew a Pittsburgher by that name. Long story short, I ordered a CD, tracked her down, and we renewed our acquaintance by email. Ann seems to have made a deep impression on everyone she met, myself included. Thomas Keegan writes about her in his memoir of being a labor lawyer, Which Side Are You On? Folk singer David Rovix has written about her on several occasions, including now a long obituary essay in counterpunch.org. In the mid-1970s, Anne, my wife Pat, and I were all in our mid-20s and doing graduate-level work at the University of Pittsburgh. One evening, Pat and I were waiting in line downtown for a performance by the radical theater troupe, The Living Theater. Out of the blue, a stranger, Anne, struck up a conversation with us. I guess we had struck her as probable kindred spirits. Here is a fond memory from those days. Anne was house-sitting a small mansion just east of the Pittsburgh city limits. She invited us and her boyfriend over for lunch and a skinny dip in the mansion's pool. Hey, when you're battling the big corporations, nobody wants a shy lawyer. We lost touch. The next thing I knew, the young Pittsburgh law student had become a labor lawyer, and afterwards a celebrated singer-songwriter and touring musician. One thing never changed. Anne was always a progressive activist, always specifically a labor activist. Now dead at 69. Another worker betrayed by the anti-labor stands of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party alike. Another worker killed by the COVID pandemic that, to say the least, the past presidential administration was in no hurry to end. We'll end the show with one of Anne's songs. I am certain that, if Anne could speak now, she would remind us of the last words of Joe Hill. Don't mourn, organize.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Flexibility.
War on the workers.
Every working stiff can see.
War on the workers.
Now when they poison your water.
War on the workers.
Don't go like lambs to the slaughter.
War on the workers.
And when they foul up the air.
War on the workers.
You gotta show that you care.
War on the workers.
When they talk WTO.
War on the workers.
You best be screaming hell no.
War on the workers.
It's a war on child labor protection. It's a war on the 8-hour day. It's a war on occupational health and safety. It's a war on social security. Now thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF, and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time we started calling the shots.